So we'll begin with verse 10 chapter 9 of 1 Kings. 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 10. And we'll begin reading there, but we won't get very far. Now it happened at the end of 20 years when Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house. Now, anytime when we run across, now it happened, that means we've got a shift of time. Either it's going to be a flashback or it's going to be something into the future from the previous paragraph. In this case, it's kind of a rehearsal of what had happened. Because it took, how many years did Josh tell you it took to build the temple? Seven. How many years to build the palace, Solomon's palace? 13. So total of 20. 20 years that he built those two houses. Verse 11, Hiram, the king of Tyre, had supplied Solomon with cedar and cypress and gold as much as he desired. That King Solomon then gave Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee. Now, if we read that and don't quite understand that, that's I can understand. I didn't. I had to have some help from the book that Josh gave me to figure that out. But what it means when he supplied this stuff means he sold it to him. Didn't just give it to him. They were pretty good buddies, and we'll find out that they have a joint venture coming up together. But Hiram is the king of Lebanon, and there my map is gone now. King of Lebanon, and we can see if we can figure out where Lebanon is, if we can have the map back. And if we can't, we'll just imagine where Lebanon is. But there we go. Okay. If you can see, there's East Manasseh over in the green. And you move directly to the Mediterranean, the Great Sea. And you get right at the right below the B of tribes of Israel. If you could see that far away, you would see the location generally of Lebanon. Famous for two things. One is the production of cedar. Got a lot of cedar trees. The second thing is that their old country name was Phoenicia. The Phoenicians became the Lebanese. And they were very adept at water stuff. They had boats. They did trading. They went all over the Mediterranean, you know, and perhaps even further in their boats. And so he had an opportunity because of that international trade to build up a pretty good coffer of gold. And he was pretty shrewd. In fact, Josephus says in his history, you can believe what Josephus says sometimes, he exaggerates other, said that Hiram and Solomon used to have little games of wits, you know. Now, Solomon was the wisest man in the world at that time. But Hiram was pretty shrewd too. And we'll see how shrewd he is right here in this verse. He takes payment for that gold and cedar and cypress in the terms of 20 cities. Now, those 20 cities, if you can see, barely see from here where the Galilean Sea is. You can see the Dead Sea down there at the bottom. Follow that on up there, the Jordan River, to the Galilean Sea. And where the blue part is, we can't tell which part that is. That is generally where those 20 cities are located. And it's very possible. Doesn't give us the name of those cities, it's very possible that those cities could have included some ancient cities that are located in where Nazareth and Cana are located. Now, that's speculation. It's a bit of a stretch, perhaps, to think that the very ground that Jesus was from and the very place where he had his turning of water to wine would be in those cities that Hiram doesn't think so highly of, because that's what he says here. Next verse. When Hiram went from Tyre to see the cities that Solomon had given him, they did not please him. He said, "What kind of cities are these you've given me, my brother?" And he called them the land of Kabul, as they are to this day. Kabul is a word that's translated good for nothing or something like, I mean, it had various translations, but that was the gist of what that Kabul meant. And one of those little cities, if you get the map close enough, has the name of Kabul. But it was a region, according to the way that Hiram referred to it. Perhaps that was one of the leading cities in that. And if so, it would have definitely included some territory very near what became Nazareth and Cana and some of those places. So, we don't know any more about this. Did he give them back to Solomon? Or did he just, you know, kind of let them flounder out there on his own? And when a king has a city given to them, it's like annexing for a city, annexing some territory on the outskirts. They have some responsibilities to take care of that city if it's theirs. The same way in ancient days. I don't know if Hiram really took responsibility for taking care of those cities or not. It doesn't say. We don't know. But apparently Solomon's needing some more support to continue with his activities. In verse 14, he sent him 120 talents of gold. Well, one speculator, I don't know if he was counting gold at $1,200 an ounce like it is today, he said, that's roughly about $131 million worth. That's what this one reference says. I don't know how much that was, but it's a whole bunch more money. So Solomon is running up a pretty big tab with Hiram. Why would he be so nice to Solomon? Does he have an ulterior motive for doing that? Is one of the 700 wives that Solomon has his daughter, one of them? Very likely, because we find out later that 700 wives were all princesses, daughters of kings, royalty, whatever terminology you want there. That's very possible that Hiram's daughter was one of those. But more than likely, Hiram is seeing some future ventures that they can have together and make some more money. We don't know that for sure, but that's a possibility. Okay, so we say 120 talents of gold, and then 15, and this is the reason for the labor force which King Solomon raised. Now, that's just a totally new paragraph, and I don't know if our outline will help us on that or not, but this is the section where you find out how he gets all of this stuff built. 20 years worth, so we may be getting more current instead of at the point where we were, and now this happened. It doesn't say that again, but for this reason, for the labor force, which King Solomon raised to build the house of the Lord, his house, the Millo, the wall of Jerusalem, Hazor, Megiddo, Gezer. Well, that verse has got a lot for us to think about there. He used all this forced labor. We're going to find out in a minute, the forced labor was anybody that his predecessors hadn't killed when Joshua took the land of Canaan. Now, some many years before, they were supposed to kill about everybody, weren't they? Well, they didn't. They let some of them live. And all these ites, and we get them listed here in a little bit, you know, the Perizzites, Gergesites, or whatever they are, and all these Hittites, and anybody else that's ite, you know, some of them were still alive. They were fair game for forced labor. But the Israelites weren't fair game for forced labor. He wasn't allowed by God to do that. But he's building his own house and the Millo, M-I-L-L-O. I searched and searched and searched and searched and tried to figure out what in the world a Millo is. The best I could come up with, it's a mound used to fill in kind of a low place. And it comes up again. It's a Millo. It's leveling out the ground. So they didn't have the dump trucks and earth movers and all those kind of things, you know, to level out the ground. So they had to do it with this forced labor. And they built that up, especially in low places in the wall that need to be repaired, as they had the wall around Jerusalem. Now, they also built the place called Hazor and Megiddo and Gezer. Now, why would he do that? Well, he anticipates that there might be some folk somewhere in the world that might want to attack him sometime. So he's building up these fortified cities. Hazor, if I can remember right, was way up north on the map that's not there now because the outline's there. Way up north. Megiddo is kind of in the middle where we were talking about, just below that 20 city areas that we've got there. Still don't have the map. Maybe we can get the map here in a minute. But Megiddo, you've always heard the Battle of Armageddon. Well, where is the Battle of Armageddon going to be fought? In the plains of Megiddo. And the plains of Megiddo was one of the flat places where you could have a lot of battles going on. When General Titus came from Rome to destroy Jerusalem, AD 69, and in 70 he got it done, he had to fight his way through the plains of Megiddo to get there. And so you've got that as a place, and it's directly in the travel path. The road goes right through Megiddo. If you're going to do any trade in Jerusalem, that'll take you all the way north to Syria and to the Euphrates and all of that whole country up in there. Or if you're going to turn left and go into what's now Turkey, or if you're going to turn right when you get up there, which is about Kurdistan, you're going to turn right and come into Iraq and Iran, you know, you're going to go through Megiddo to get there. So it's a good place to be fortified, and it's a good place to have a lot of fighting. Gezer, that's the spot that is down about where that turquoise bluish place is down there. You see the Dead Sea, you see Moab on one side. I think it says Simeon, if you can see that, just barely say Simeon. Yeah. Well, Gezer is down there. And it doesn't tell us here why that's strategic, but it is helping cut off anybody from the south that's going to come and beat up on you. So that's the reason that he built up those fortified cities. Now, new subject altogether, verse 16. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and taken Gezer and burnt it with fire and killed the Canaanites who dwelt in the city and had given it as a dowry to his daughter, Solomon's wife. Okay, that particular little section down there, when Joshua and the other guys that came and beat up on the people, they're supposed to kill them, they didn't kill hardly any of those folks. So they were pretty much still in the control of the Canaanites. Now, it being so close to Egypt, further on down where you got Egypt, not on the screen there, Pharaoh, who gave his daughter, is one of these 700 wives, to Solomon, says, as a tribute to you, as a dowry to you, I'll just go up and take care of Gezer, burn it to the ground, and rebuild it as a gift to you, my daughter. And it won't make bad relations at all for me and Solomon either. See his ulterior motive? And we'll find out that some 40 years later, toward the end, this is right at the beginning of Solomon's reign, 40 years later, they got a different Pharaoh. And the relationship with Egypt is not quite so good. Okay, so we've got that situation. Solomon built Gezer, built it up, fortified it some more. He took care of Lower Beth Horan and Baalath. Now, these two cities are on the road that's very possible that the Ethiopian eunuch and Philip were taking. Possibly. But it left Jerusalem and went directly to the Mediterranean Sea. So if you can see where the Dead Sea there, you see Jerusalem barely. If you go straight west, then you'll run into these two spots, Lower Beth Horon and Baalath. And then there's Tadmor in the wilderness in the land of Judah. And we got Judah on the map there somewhere. Yep, it's in the same kind of, it's the brown one right where the turquoise Simeon is in the middle of. Now, it's in a strategic location that's heading on down alongside the Dead Sea all the way out. And if you can picture the Sinai Peninsula that makes a kind of a V, you know, the Red Sea is on this side and it comes back around and the Red Sea's over there. Well, it's this right fork, on the my right anyway, of the Red Sea, where he's going to build a city and he's going to put a fleet of ships there. In the joint venture I talked about with Hiram, going to put some ships there and do a lot of trade that will take him on down the Red Sea, down into the Arabian Sea, into the Indian Ocean, perhaps all the way around South Africa, over to East Africa, because he's going to get some apes and baboons from somewhere. Because we read about that a couple of chapters down the road. And we're going to get some trees that are special, some wood that's pretty special. And he's going to get that. And it says that these shipping vessels, you know, the trade ships, took them 3 years to complete the route. So that's a pretty good haul, you know. But every 3 years they would make complete the trip. From wherever they went with stuff from Solomon to wherever they got back with whatever they brought that was of tremendous value. So we've got that as a protection from that particular travel location. That was Tadmor in the wilderness in the land of Judea. Now, in addition to these fortified cities, He has storage cities for his chariots and cities for his cavalry. And whatsoever Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and all the land of his dominion. So, he's having these other locations. Now, in the fine print, especially in the commentaries, and they have usually a pretty good basis for making that statement, the storehouse cities were 12 strategically located places. And the requirement for the administrator of those storehouse cities, 12 of them, is you guys have got to come up with 1 month's worth of supplies to take care of King Solomon and his court. So that's your responsibility. So you're going to have to store up the grain, store up whatever it is that you need, and be prepared when your month comes around that you take that to Solomon to keep his lavish lifestyle going. Just one of the things that makes Solomon, when we get to the end of his life, them accusing him of being a pretty harsh taskmaster that required a lot of taxation during his life. And that was one of the things that happened to make him believe that, is that he had his responsibility for keeping up his lifestyle was based on these storehouse cities. And this kind of hints that this king of Lebanon here, Hiram, may have been kind of in on it too, because it says desired to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and in all the land of his dominion. So, all the people who are left, verse 20, are the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and Jebusites, who were not of the children of Israel, that is, their descendants, who were left in the land after them, whom the children of Israel had not been able to destroy completely. From these Solomon raised the forced labor, as it is to this day. So that's where we got what I told you a minute ago about all these ites providing the forced labor, the slave labor. Now, it caught my attention, and I don't know if it does anybody else's, of that's the way it is to this day. Well, I don't think that's 2017 they're talking about. Do you? So what this day is this day. So we have to go back and remember what Josh told us when I wasn't paying a whole lot of attention because I had forgotten it. When was this written? And by whom was this written? And would that give us a clue as to what the author's description of till this day would mean? So, anybody remember? No, you didn't pay any closer attention than I did when he said that. The most leading suspect for who wrote 1 Kings was none other than Jeremiah. And when did Jeremiah do his writing? Anybody remember that? No, I didn't either. I'd forgotten totally. Jeremiah was writing his stuff during the Babylonian captivity times. Now, when was the Babylonian captivity? No, I didn't remember that either. So I had to look it up. And it's somewhere. And he said, I remember him saying this, ish. I remember that part of it. 550-ish, 560-ish, 590-ish. You know, pick your number. Somewhere between 550 B.C. and 590 B.C. would be a good guess, is when Jeremiah wrote this. And what is the timeline of where we're talking about? Well, we've got some pretty good evidence of when this is. From all the kings lived so many years and died, and during the whichever reign that was of that guy, another guy in the other kingdom, you know, started his, and he did so. So we can get a pretty good handle on about when this is all happening. And you can pick an ish somewhere between 950 and 1000 B.C. Get in the neighborhood. So from 990 to 590, if my arithmetic is right, would be about 400 years. 400 years later, it's still the case of these ites. All the ites are still forced labor. You know, or could be. They were candidates for forced labor anyway, because they're not supposed to be there anyway. If they had obeyed God when he told them to kill all those people, they wouldn't be there. But their remnants and their descendants and all those are still there. So the only good thing to do with those guys is make them work for you. Well, some of the Israelites did do some work. And it tells us about their role as we keep on going here. All the people, all those ites, who are not the Israelites, that is, their descendants who were left because they weren't destroyed there, forced labor unto this day. But of the children of Israel, 22, Solomon made no forced laborers because they were men of war and his servants, his officers, his captains, commanders of his chariots and his cavalry. Others were chiefs to the officials who were over Solomon's work. So, you could be a supervisor of the forced labor, but you couldn't be the forced labor. And your biggest role was to be all the stuff that were just mentioned there. And there was 550 who ruled over the people who did the work. 24, but Pharaoh's daughter came up from the city of David to her house, which Solomon had built for her. Then he built the millo, which is that strange word for filling in the land where the low place is. Now, three times a year, Solomon offered burnt offerings and peace offerings on the altar which he had built for the Lord, and he burnt incense with them on the altar that was before him. So he finished the temple. So we've now finally got back to live time. We started with this statement way back over there now it happened. Now we're back to live time. Got the temple finished. And now he offers the sacrifices. Now, it does not mean, according to the scholars, that he took on the priestly role of physically offering those sacrifices and stuff, but he saw to it that it was done and had the right people do it. Because at this point in time, he hasn't strayed from the Lord quite as much as what he's going to. Because he's going to make the Lord pretty mad at him. And in just a couple of chapters, we're going to see how mad God gets at Solomon. So we finished the temple. 26, King Solomon built a fleet of ships at Ezion-Geber, which is that place I told you about that's down there at the mouth of the right fork of the Red Sea. It's on the east side of the Sinai Peninsula, right down there at the mouth of that. He's going to get this fleet, which is near Elath, which it could very easily be a city that he just built. There's not a lot of story behind Elath, but it is in the land of Edom. And if you got a map that shows that, Edom is over there just south of Moab. And do you remember what Edom means? The Hebrew word meaning what? Red. Red. And Edom has another name as well, and that's Esau. And who was Esau? No. Now it's all beginning to fall in place. Down there, it was where people that are going to be against Israel all their life is where this was. So they might have had a little bit of reason to need to have that kind of fortified down there, because culturally they're going to be different. In fact, you got the Moabites and the Ammonites, and you remember where they came from? Lot's. Yeah. The unique situation of Lot's grandchildren and children, because of the incestual relationship that he had with his daughters. They were his kids as well as his grandkids. Those guys. Ben-Ammi was one of them that became the Ammonites, and Moab became the Moabites. So we've got all these relationships that come up and go away, and they're seething there waiting to happen again as Israel has its history. So he built his fleet, and Hiram, from way up in Lebanon, verse 27, sent his servants with the fleet, seamen who knew the sea, to work with the servants of Solomon. So they knew how to be seafaring people, but being landlocked like Jerusalem was, not too many of those people know how to row a boat even, probably. Verse 28, and they went to Ophir and acquired 420 talents of gold from there and brought it to King Solomon. Now, I made a mistake Sunday morning when I was teaching down Jog Road in John, and I said something about, well, this place nobody knows anything about. The last reference I had said that there wasn't much information available on that. And one of the brothers said, well, I just read where this happened, this happened, this happened. He had some more current information. So I hate to say that nobody knows where Ophir is. Ophir. Nobody that I could find any references anywhere that knew where that was. So somebody, if you've read something contrary, or has anybody figured out since then, but whatever it was, must have been a pretty long way off and must have had a lot of good gold and good trading partners. Okay? So he makes 420 talents worth of gold there. And how much was the 120 over here back in 14? Verse 14 was 131 million, according to this calculation. Be about nearly three times that much. So we got about $500 million worth of money. So do you think Hiram maybe made the good choice of loaning him a little bit of money there and charging maybe a little bit of interest on it and making for a good partner and a good venture here going? No. So Hiram, pretty shrewd guy. Chapter 10. All this seafaring stuff and all this world trade, international relationships, has got some folk's attention. And one of them is the Queen of Sheba. Now, if you can think of the map, and I didn't, I just had Shay come up with this map, but if I had a bigger one of the entire Middle East, and you picture Saudi Arabia on their big Arabian area there, and you go down to the very south edge of it, you got the countries of Yemen and Oman and United Arab Emirates. And then you come on up in the Gulf, the Persian Gulf there, and you get to Kuwait and a few of those other little whistle stops in between there. It's Yemen. Right down there at the end is where the ancient country of Sheba was located. So this gal has got a 1,500-mile trip to come to see Solomon. And she comes and hears of him, decides she'll come and test him with some questions and all this stuff, and I'll make it a shortcut here. You know, she brings a lot of stuff with her. Verse 6, she said to the king, "It was true that I heard about this land and your words of wisdom." 7, "However, I did not believe the words until I came and saw it with my own eyes, and indeed the half was not told me." The half was not told. It was so much more, so much better than anything that anybody had ever told her. And that her reaction to that was such that she even says some nice things about the kingdom. And Jesus references that in Matthew 12 when he said to some guys he was calling out, he said, "The people of Nineveh will rise up in judgment to you." Jonah, because remember, Jonah preached to them and he was disappointed that they believed, but they did. "And the queen of the south can have judgment against you," when she came to see Solomon. So you read that in Matthew 12, you know, it's referencing the same person. And Novell is back there making strange signs to me. I think I have quit. I think I'm done for the night.